beautiful morning this morning. It's cooled off a little bit. It might get hot this afternoon. If it does get hot this afternoon, what I'd encourage you to do is to find the hottest place in this center. Put on all of your clothes and as many blankets as you can find. Because that's actually what Ajahn Chah used to teach us to do. In the hot season in northeast Thailand, we used to have one room in his monastery. He's taken it down now and built another hall there. It used to be, we called it the old sala. And it had a very low steel roof. And after the meal, when you only eat one meal a day, and you felt a bit tired anyway, in the hot season, you get all the monks to go in there. You have to wear all your robes. And even though there was electric fans, he would never turn them on. Even though there were windows, he closed them. And he'd sit meditation for 2 hours. After that, he never complained about the heat. The point is that sometimes it does not matter just what temperature it is. You can always find fault with the conditions around you. It's not the temperature. It's not the facilities. It's you. It's the mind. And when you understand that, you understand the complaining mind is not at all to do with what's happening outside of you. It's always the way you look at it. You can always find fault with anything if you really want to. And when we understand that, we understand just how we get this fault-finding mind, which is one of the biggest hindrances to meditation. Sometimes, because in our jobs at home we are managers, we've been trained to see the faults and to fix them. Even when you go home, you look at all the dishes in the sink, which are dirty. But I try and teach people, don't look at all the dirty dishes, look at all the dishes in the cupboards which have already been cleaned. You don't feel so bad. And it's true, you can see what's going on there, you think that's crazy, but when we see the faults, and there's always some faults there, we always have jobs to be done, work to be done, and we can never rest, we can never be at peace. That I know that as the abbot of a monastery, that it was the time that you come to our city centre in Olamar of the weekend, and you work really hard doing things there. And then when you go back home to your monastery, then you'd work really hard there as well. You'd never get any rest. And of course, I saw myself, when I got back to the monastery, looking at all the things which needed to be done the next week. And that would give you a lot of a burden, a lot of stress. So instead of looking at all the things which needed to be done the next week, on a Monday morning I'd go for a walk, and I'd deliberately look at all the things which had been done. Look at all the things which had been completed. Look at all the things in the monastery which were perfect. Just for one morning a week. And of course, that gave me peace, that gave me inspiration, that gave me joy. And it also taught me a great trick in meditation. When you're meditating, do you think of all the stages which lie ahead of you? And get negative and think, oh, I haven't got into the beautiful breath yet. I haven't got the nimittas yet. Or you may have got third jhana. I haven't got fourth jhana yet. You see, you can get negative no matter what you're experiencing if you have that negative mind. But if you have the opposite mind, oh, isn't it wonderful? I've actually made it to this retreat. I'm just sitting here. My mind may be all over the place. I may be restless. I may be tired. I've made it here. What a wonderful thing it is I'm doing. Now when you have that degree of appreciation for what you have achieved already, and by achievement I mean you've made it to your meditation cushion. That for many people is a great achievement. Sometimes people can't even get that far. You've come here. Congratulations. Well done. Now when you find joy in what you've already done, you find it's easy to gain contentment, it's easy to be at peace. You're not trying to fix up all the faults and get somewhere further. in your life, you're quite happy to rest with how far you've come. And of course, once you start resting and accepting where you've come, you are developing contentment and letting go. When I started walking around my monastery and looking for the beauty, it's amazing how much beauty I saw. Many of you who come to visit either of our monasteries, at Dharamsala or at Bodhinyana, you come and say, oh, what a beautiful monastery that is. And sometimes when I go there, or Sister Wayam or Sister Nirvana, they think, oh, this needs to be fixed up, oh, that needs to be swept, that needs to be done. And sometimes you look at your monasteries in different ways, as a visitor or as a worker. And so I had to learn how to enjoy my monastery, to look at it as a visitor looks at it, not as an owner. Now you can look upon your meditation the same way, not as an owner of your meditation, because if you own your meditation, you've got to fix it up. Look at your meditation as a visitor. Oh, isn't this wonderful? That you are just sitting here, nice and peaceful. This is good enough for me. When you do that, you start to appreciate where you are. When you start to appreciate, you get happiness. When you get happiness, the mind becomes still, and all those stages of meditation arrive from that point, from the point of happiness. In the talk I'm going to give this morning, it's about the five hindrances, but it's also the reason why we can't get deeper into meditation is because of a lack of happiness. We're just too fault-finding, we see everything which is wrong, that creates work. We can never be still. We can never just rest and do nothing. One of those key stories which you'll find in that book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, concerns a great meditation monk called Ajahn Buddhadasa, who, there's a time when he was building his main hall in his monastery. When it came to the rains retreat, when all the monks stopped work, he sent the builders home. And a few days later, when a visitor came and he saw that hall, he said to Ajahn Buddhadasa, when is your hall going to be finished? And Ajahn Buddhadasa, the great monk, said, it is finished. What do you mean it's finished? There is no roof on the building. There's no windows. There's cement bags lying around and pieces of wood all over the place. Are you going to leave it like that? Is that what you call finished? How can you say it's finished? And with great wisdom, this great monk said, what's done is finished. And then he left to go meditate. Isn't that beautiful? What's done is finished. How else can you get some peace in your life? Otherwise, you'd be working throughout your whole life, because there's always something more to do. What's done is finished. So can you do that in your meditation as well? What's done is finished. So I'm going to sit here, I've got to this seat, and just let go. Now, when there's nothing to do, when there's no work to be done, when you're not trying to get into jhanas or get enlightened or get here or get there, then you might find a bit of peace and happiness in your meditation. You might start to appreciate the moment when you're not demanding so much of it. Do you remember that phrase we do in the chant in the morning and the evening about the Metta Sutta? This is what should be done. Let you not be demanding in nature, that you be easily satisfied. Are you demanding in nature? You sit here and write, I'm not going to move until I get the nimitta. And after you said, there goes another meditation, I never really got very far. Are you easily satisfied or hard to satisfy? Are you really demanding of your meditation? If you are, you've got what we call desire. That sensory desire is the first of the hindrances. I want, I want, I want, I want, I want. How can you ever find any peace with so much wanting? So in our meditation, we have to look, what do you want? Some people, they want to have jhanas. You haven't got a clue what jhana is. Why do you want it? Some of you haven't got a clue what it is. It must be I'm a great salesman. I'm selling you this thing. You haven't got a clue what it is. But yeah, I want it, please. And you put forth so much effort to try and get these jhanas. Maybe when you get the jhanas, you wish you didn't have it in the first place. So, stop all this wanting business. The whole purpose, we have to mention these stages just to give you an idea of what's happening. But please don't bring in your worldly ways of, yeah, I see this, I want it. Because if you put in those worldly ways, I want, I want, I want, I want, you are building up this first hindrance of wanting. And when you want something, that very moment when you put forth that desire, I want something else. In Buddhism we call it, you're separated from the object of your desire. That is called suffering. In the very wanting, there is immediately suffering. So thirst is a lack of peace. It means you have to start doing something. You cannot sit still. One of in my early years I used to do this mantra, it's no desire. No desire, no desire. I use that as a mantra, to repeat it to myself, and if I saw any desire come up in my mind, I'd stop it straight away. No desire, no desire, no desire. What that meant was whatever came into my mind, I accepted it completely, fully, without any criticism at all. Just no desire. I started getting very peaceful. The thoughts stopped. All thought is about desiring something. All thought begins with discontent. You're not happy where you are. And so the thought comes along either to distract your experience, to take you away from this, or to plan to go somewhere else. So when you had no desire, it soon brought up contentment, peace. The point is that with sensory desire, the Buddha actually called it like you're taking out a loan. You're borrowing something. You have to pay it back afterwards. When you desire something, it leaves the mind bereft of energy, bereft of peace. So if you've lost some of your resource, some of your money, some of your good karma, so instead of trying to want so much, see if we can just allow this moment to be. Be someone who is easily contented, who is not demanding from one's meditation, who is not fault-finding. We can just sit here and just say, this is good enough. No desire. This is good enough. Like that novice I talked about last night, you're stopping. Stopping the movement of the mind which is created by desire. The hindrance which stops you being still. Sometimes the Buddha called it the itch. Sometimes there's an itch in your nose. That's why some people have got a bit of hay fever right now. Getting onto into the tissue papers. Sometimes people have got an itch in their stomach. They want to eat something. But all of us have got an itch in our mind. We want something else. We want something more. We want something new. Something different. And that is the itch which stops you being still. Whenever there's an itch, it's always followed by a scratch. And when you scratch something, it just inflames the itch. And you have to scratch somewhere else. Have you ever noticed that in meditation? You may be sitting here and you have an itch somewhere in your body. You think, I'll just scratch that itch so it goes away. And as soon as you scratch one itch, another itch comes up somewhere else. If it's not an itch, it's an ache. As soon as you scratch one itch, it's as if all the other potential itches in your body realize that now you're open to their calls, and someone else will call you up for a scratch. This is what happens with the body. If you don't scratch the first itch, then all the itches disappear. If you don't scratch that first desire, you leave it alone. This is good enough. Then soon all the other desires just fade away. You're not at home. You're not going to follow desires, cravings. You find this is good enough. No desire. What's done is done. You can't see any faults, so why fix things up? Later on, when you come out of meditation, when you go home, there'll be plenty of time to desire to do things in the world, but not now. So the very fact you've come here is good enough. The very fact you're sitting on the cushion, that's good enough. Don't try and do too much. Don't try and find fault with your meditation. Appreciate it. Be kind to yourself. Give yourself on a pat on the back. You've managed to sit still for 5 minutes. Oh, well done, me. That's good enough. When you take away that desire, sometimes people think you're taking away your motivation. Yeah, you're taking away your motivation to crave. And what's left is a motivation to stay still, to be at peace, and to go deep in meditation. Because this is the first hindrance which comes up, is that desire, especially the desire in the realm of the five senses, to get comfort in the body. Can your body ever be comfortable? Why is it that all the people are always moving? They're just moving their hands, scratching their hair, just bending their body, or they're just scratching their nose, or they're blinking their eyelids. Why do you keep on doing that? Scratching your nose again, scratching the back of your neck, looking around, scratching your back, scratching your shirt, your forehead, blowing your nose. We're always doing things with our body. Why is that? It's because our body's never at peace. It's so demanding, our body. And this is actually trying to find comfort in this body. We think, if I just move it this way, then I'll be happy. If I just scratch that, then I'll be at peace. There never is a peace that way. If you try and do things, it never creates peace. It just makes the leaf move even more. So, in meditation, we don't have to leave the body alone. No desire. This is good enough. If it's got an itch, fine, it can itch. If it's got an ache, fine, it can ache. If there's a mozzie biting me, fine, you can bite me. It's only a tiny bit of blood. I've got plenty left for myself afterwards. Whatever it is, you can actually let go and be at peace. So you have no desires for the five senses. You're not looking for comfort. You're not finding fault with your body. Sometimes I find myself doing that. Sometimes because of boredom. You're watching the breath and you're bored. You think, I wonder what's going on in the body. Just like turning on the TV, I wonder what's on the television. You haven't got a television, but you've got a body. So you go down looking at your knees, what's going on down there? This is actually what you do. You look for something to distract yourself. You find if you look at the body, there's always something to distract you because the body's never at peace. There's no happiness to be found in the body. There's only problems to be found. So instead of looking at what's wrong in the body, we look at what's right. We just appreciate this body. This is good enough. What's done is done. I've sat down, I've got myself comfortable, now I'm going to leave it alone. What's done is finished. So you go off somewhere else. So that way you can actually remain peaceful with the body. You can let it go. And when you start looking at what's right with the body, what's right with you, this fault-finding mind which creates work is taken away. You have nothing to do. This is good enough. When there's nothing to do, you do nothing. So you're at peace at last. If you've got this great goal, I want to get jhana, I want to get enlightened in this retreat, and I've got many other things to do in my life, I've come all this way, if I don't get enlightened, it's wasted all my money. Don't think like that, otherwise it just makes some more work for yourself. And meditation is never peaceful when you're doing work. So we stop that. We stop the fault-finding mind. We stop wanting things in the future. We're appreciative of what we have now. When we have that appreciation of what we have now, it also overcomes the second hindrance of ill will. I don't want this, I want something else. I don't want the ache. I don't want the mosquito. Why does it always come to me? Why didn't it go to those monks? The monks are much more compassionate. You know, why do they always come just when I'm about to get still in meditation? Why does that person sitting next to me always have to cough just when I'm about to get into jhana? Why? It's too much easier to get into a will, which is another part of fault-finding mind. In one of these meditation centers in the US, they built this meditation center. They had heaps and heaps and heaps of money. And so they decided to build the best meditation center you could ever build, state of the art. And when they built the meditation center, they were always looking for ways to improve it. They had a laundry. You pick up all your belongings at the door and they'd wash it for you. They had like a menu. I don't know if they had breakfast in bed, but maybe they're thinking about that. Imagine that retreat center. We had breakfast in bed, you had a menu, you could actually choose the day before what you wanted to eat. You had your own room with an ensuite, air conditioned. And above you at your meditations, so you have lots of space with like personal air conditioning coming up from up the top there. Imagine your perfect meditation center. You know, with a sort of a heated cushion when it's too cold, or you know, cool. Imagine your perfect meditation center. This is what they tried to do, get the perfect meditation center. But somebody had the bright idea. They couldn't think how to improve it further. So they put in a suggestions box, thinking, oh, I will find out from our meditators, our yogis, some ideas of how we can improve it. And they couldn't believe it. Just after a few hours, the suggestion box was crammed full with suggestions. Almost it seemed to be the closer you get to perfection, the more complaints you have. Even in like first world countries, people are far more fault-finding than in third world countries. Strange, isn't it? And the closer you get to perfection, if you're not careful, the more you find fault with it. It's almost there, but not quite. And that's why the more perfect your partner, the more you find fault with them. No worries. What we're saying there, this fault-finding mind knows no bounds. You can never get perfection. You can even imagine go to a heaven realm and people still find fault there. Having these white clothes all the time. Always having to eat ambrosia for breakfast, lunch. Can't we have some noodles for a change? Why? Whatever else you want. It's so easy to find fault. But when you find fault, it's coming from ill will. Why is it we find fault in things? We're actually looking. Because we've got a bad mind. We want to find something wrong. It's called ill will. If you have ill will, you can have ill will towards three things in meditation. You can have ill will towards yourself, ill will towards the teachings, or ill will towards your meditation object. Among many others. You can have ill will to other people as well, but those are the three main ones. Ill will towards yourself. You say, oh, I'm hopeless. Oh, I can't do this. Or you have ill will to say, oh, I've been meditating for 2 days now. I bet everyone else has at least got the limiter, but not me. That ill will towards yourself will crush you, will force you. It's just like a person who's got a child, who's not kind to that child, who doesn't allow them to grow, but forces them to grow. And puts stress and tension and puts too many demands and too many goals on themselves. So don't act with ill will towards yourself. Don't act with ill will towards a meditation object. If it's present moment awareness. I know some of you have trouble with present moment. Oh, present moment bloody awareness. No, that even happened. This present bloody moment awareness is driving me crazy. So don't have ill will towards the meditation object. People do that to the breath as well. And they're going to watch the breath again another hour. Yuck. Instead we have this sense of peace, loving kindness, gentleness towards our meditation object. That's why they always say invite the meditation object in. Be gentle with it. In the present moment awareness. Doesn't matter how long it takes to get to know you. I'm going to just be gentle and patient. Just like you're teaching a child who's a slow learner. Just allow that to give it as much time as it needs. Come on, you'll be able to manage it. You're gentle, you have loving kindness, you have compassion. to your meditation object. If it's the breath, you don't go and crush the breath. You don't crush your mind as well. Now, I've given a simile before in our meditation groups in Dolomara, that sometimes we're trying to calm the mind down, and we sometimes compare it to a child. And if you've got a son or a daughter, and you're tucking it in bed at night and trying to get it nice and peaceful and calm so you can go to sleep so you can do your other things. If you want to get a child to go to sleep at night, maybe a 5 or 6 year old, do you grab it by the throat and look it in the eye? If you don't go to sleep quickly, you're going to be in big trouble. Come on, get to sleep. Imagine what they would do to a 5 year old child. They really get wound up so much they wouldn't go to sleep for hours. Now, do you understand what you do to your poor mind? You grab hold of your mind by the throat and say, come on, watch the breath, come on, get into present moment awareness, come on. No wonder your mind gets wound up and is never peaceful. The way to settle a child at night is actually to stroke them on a now child. It's all the same. That's a lovely dream. The child goes to sleep. That's what you do with your mind. Nice mind. Beautiful mind. Now, shh. Just watch the present moment, okay? Shh. Present moment awareness. No future. Shh. No past. Shh. No fantasies and dreams. No thinking about lunch. Shh. There you are. And you find your mind does it. Because it's kind. Then you do anything. I found that being an abbot of a monastery. I want to get something out of my monks. I wouldn't actually strike them on the head, but I'd do it metaphysically and say, nice monk, kind monk. If you wouldn't mind digging that big hole for the next 4 hours. It works, because people respond to kindness, just like your mind responds to kindness. So don't have ill will and force a mind. Because if you have ill will and force of mind, the result of ill will is maybe you may get fear. Maybe you might try out of fear. Fear of failure. Or fear of being told off afterwards. But you know in meditation retreats you don't get told off. Even the most stupid of disciples at the end of the retreat I never tell you off. We don't give report cards at the end of the retreat. We don't give you grades, A, B, C, D, E, and F for failure. So you don't get judged at all. And that way you're kind. And so we're not trying to live up to it, we're not afraid of censure. So when we don't have ill will, we have kindness. Then of course that hindrance is gone. It's the same with ill will towards the teaching. Sometimes you may get so frustrated. So these teachings, this meditation, all this advice, it doesn't work. Now, it does work, but you just got ill will towards it. You don't allow it to happen. Your job is just to get out of the way and just allow it to happen. I've been saying, and again in Nolamara, meditation, coming on a retreat, is just like going on Singapore Airlines. You get on board, you sit down, and once you're on board, you don't have to do anything. Sometimes people think, I'm going to really strive. And they run to the front of the plane, thinking they're going to get there earlier. Other people, they linger at the back of the plane. And people think, oh, they're lazy. You find if you're in the back of the plane or the front of the plane, you get to the destination at the same time. So if you go on an aircraft to go overseas, what do? Your effort is actually to get on the plane and sit down. Once you sit down, all you do is to sit down, be quiet, and enjoy the in-flight service. Not the in-flight service, the inside service. That's what happens when you sit on your chair, your cushion, and you get insight. You just sit down and it happens, it comes to you. So here in this meditation, don't have ill will towards the meditation object, or towards the teaching, or towards yourself, be kind. Which is why that you can combine sort of this kindness, this compassion, this loving kindness with every meditation object. Many years ago, at a retreat, I decided to combine loving kindness and breath meditation. It was fantastic, the results. When you actually combine the breath and loving kindness, you say, breath, the door of my heart's open to you, come in. With kindness, with gentleness. And you're looking upon your breath, not with ill will. Come on, watch the breath. Breathing in, breathing out. I'm going to watch you no matter what. You do it with beautiful kindness. Beautiful breath. A lovely breath. I started to what's called anthropomorphize. Look upon the breath and give it a character, give it a name. I called it my baby. Now for those of you who are mothers, if you were holding the baby in your hand, in your arms, sorry, and you're walking down the road, would you ever drop your baby? If you went to the shopping mall to buy some stuff, would you ever leave your baby in the mall and not really remember where you've left it? Of course not, it's your baby, you love it, you care for it. But that's what you do with the breath. Sometimes you're walking on the path of meditation, you drop the breath somewhere, you're not quite sure where, you leave it in the mall. I haven't got a clue, where did I leave my breath? It shows you don't care for it. Who would do that to a baby? But you do it to your breath. It's because you've got no loving kindness to your breath. If you really had loving kindness towards your breath, oh, you beautiful breath, you nice breath, you look upon it as your baby, as your friend, as your companion. If it just disappeared for a few moments, where's it gone? And you find it straight away. It wouldn't be like seconds or minutes go past and you don't know where the breath has gone because you've been thinking about something else. The breath is important to you because of care makes it important, makes it valuable. Say your loving kindness towards the breath. Beautiful breath, like a little baby, like my best friend. Think of this breath and what it's done to you over all of these years. It's fed you oxygen every day of your life. It's taken away all of these toxins and waste products from your body. And it's done it 24 hours a day, even when you're asleep. It's never complained. Have you ever really thanked your breath? Thank you, breath, for all that hard work. Are you grateful to your breath for keeping you alive? Have you ever said, oh, I really care about you, you're just so wonderful to me? Have you ever shown your appreciation to your breath? Now is the time when you sit down and close your eyes and watch this beautiful breath. You've been so kind to me, looking after me for all these years, being my best friend. I've neglected you, I haven't cared for you, but now I'm going to care and be kind to you. When you make a nice little play around the breath, you have kindness towards the breath stays in mind easily. It's not that hard at all, or the present moment. How much have you neglected the present moment in all your life? How long have you really been here? Or how much, many of your years have you been spent doing something else? Why is it that people say time flies? How old are you now? How fast the years have gone by? And it's quite obvious. Why? It's because you've never been here when time was happening. You've always been somewhere else. That's why most of our life has been missed. But now you have the chance to enjoy life. Life is what happens now, not tomorrow, not yesterday. You've wasted too much of your life already being somewhere else. Now you can be here. So we love the present moment. We care for the present moment. Beautiful present moment. Life, thank you for being here. Then with loving kindness towards these meditation objects, you find that they stay. Because you're overcoming this ill will, this lack of softness towards your meditation object, towards the teaching, towards yourself. We're far too hard as human beings. We feed on ill will. Now we're softening. So any time in meditation you can do ill, you can not do ill will, you can do do loving kindness towards whatever you're experiencing now. Even if you're restless, do loving kindness towards your restlessness. Oh, mind, you must be restless because of some reason. That's okay. Go on. You can be as restless as you like. I'll be kind to you. If you want to play around, that's fine with me. So you do loving kindness towards your restless mind. And I guarantee you, it will not last all that long. If you're sleepy, you've already heard me say to give loving kindness towards your sleepy mind. Oh, you poor mind. You know, you've been working so hard, you're probably still jet lagged. Oh, mind, go and take a nice rest, okay? I'll be here for you when you wake up. So be kind to your restless mind, and then you stop the tightness and the tension, which ties you out. When you have that softness and loving kindness towards your restless mind, it disappears very quickly. That's why ill will is one of the worst of the hindrances. And you know if that's your big hindrance, when you try loving kindness and you start getting peaceful. Ah, that was what my problem was. Too much ill will. Sometimes the ill will towards myself, I'm not getting deep enough, quick enough. How many days have gone past? 3 days already! My goodness, that's a third of the retreat. I've only got 6 days left. I'm getting nowhere. Ah! Have loving kindness towards yourself. That's all right. Even if you don't go anywhere, I'll still be your friend. You've got to have failures in life. If you didn't have failures, the successful people wouldn't feel so good. That's what he used to say at school, this story about him when I was a school teacher. 30 kids in my class, and one of them came bottom. They had to come bottom of the class. There always has to be in a class of 30, someone who comes 30th. So I went to see this poor little boy. When he got his report card, it was only at the end of the year, you could see, just he looked at it and thought, oh no, how am I going to show this to my parents? How am I going to show this to my friends? He was afraid and very upset. He was depressed. You could see that in his face. So out of compassion, as his school teacher, I went up to him and I taught him some Buddhism. I taught him some Mahayana Buddhism about bodhisattvas. You know what bodhisattvas are? They're beings who sacrifice themselves for the sake of other people's happiness. They give up, you know, what is in their interests so that other people can find joy. And I said, that's you! You have taken this terrible position of 30th in the class, so no other child in this class has to take that terrible position. You've taken on all this suffering, this ignominy, this shame upon yourself to prevent other people having that shame. You are like a bodhisattva. You sacrificed your happiness for the sake of the 29 other children in this class. You are so kind. You are so wise and compassionate. You did this on purpose. I know it. And according to that story, he looked at me as if I was absolutely crazy, which I was. But it worked, because he laughed, and it just broke the depression there. And there's some truth in that. Someone has to be the idiot of the class. How many people have we got here? 42, 43 people? It always has to be the worst meditator of this class. Is it 42 or 43 people, Chris?
It's 40.
40. Okay, so one of you has to come 40th. One of you has to get the very, very worst meditation. So whatever one that is, you are the bodhisattva. So you're feeling good about yourself, being kind about yourself, instead of, ooh, I'm hopeless, I'm terrible. What that means is you have no ill will. We've really got that sort of attitude. The bodhisattvas get enlightened first. Because they've got no ill will, they've got no sort of feeling about what they want, what's for me, they've got no personal desires, they're letting go. They're giving up, they're giving away. That way you get enlightened quickly. You get peaceful very quickly. So you can do loving kindness with everything. And the third hindrance which people have is what a strange why people get worried about this one. Of all the hindrances, this is the one you least need to worry about. It's called sloth and torpor. And the reason why it's the least you need to worry about is because one of the famous nodders in the time of the Buddha was Mahamoggallana. Because the Buddha, actually, it's in the suttas, he caught him nodding. He was meditating, he was nodding this way, nodding that way. And look what happened to him. couple of days later, he became one of the great arahats with all the psychic powers. So those of you who want psychic powers, you find yourself nodding, that might be you. And number two, there's another story about the Buddha was going with his disciple Ananda. He's walking through the forest and he saw this monk in the edge of the forest, sitting perfectly straight. Absolutely straight back, motionless, perfect position. And he turned around to Ananda and said, I'm worried about that monk. Sure enough, a week later, he disrobed and got married. When he went deeper into the forest, he saw another monk who was nodding all over the place. Really so in sloth and torpor. And the Buddha smiled. He said, I'm not worried about him at all. Another week or two later, he was an arahat, fully enlightened. What's going on there? Surely isn't sloth and torpor a hindrance? Something which is wrong? It is a hindrance, but it's one of the least problematical. At least you're peaceful. It's just you're not aware enough to appreciate it. But at least you're peaceful. Great. When you're peaceful and you allow sloth and torpor to be, it's only a matter of time, as I was saying, when the energies start to come back and you keep that peace. Only the awareness starts to improve. Be still at peace. Just awareness comes. The awareness doesn't send you off into restlessness. You maintain the peacefulness. So sloth and torpor, it comes up. You may be close to psychic powers. You may be close to being enlightened. This might be you. So don't worry about it, be kind to it. When you don't worry about it, you're kind to it. Of course, it doesn't last all that long. Why are people tired with sloth and torpor? You're tired with sloth because you haven't slept enough, because the body needs a bit more of a break, because the body is tired. It's nature. Your genes or hormones, whatever else it is going through your body, tells you you're tired. It's nature. Be kind to nature. Flow with nature. Don't go fighting nature. That's what it is, cause and effect. It's nothing to do with you. It's the nature of your body. And the nature of your mind, the reason why your mind has torpor, it just really can't do very much, it can't be mindful, because you've been working it too hard, thinking too much, straining your mind. You strain your mind because I'm going to really do this. You're thinking a lot, complaining, causes a lot of tiredness of the mind. Striving, complaining, doing, controlling, thinking. Imagine if you're thinking a lot, you use up a lot of brain juice. You've only got so much juice in your brain. And after a while, you use it all up. Well, if you use it all up, that's called that dullness of torpor. Nature, that's all. So how are you going to overcome just a lack of energy in the mind? By wasting more energy, by striving and trying hard? Is that going to work? Of course it doesn't. Leave it alone. Be at peace with sloth and torpor. Say, sloth and torpor, the door of my heart's open to you. Come in. Be at peace with it. Stop being so egocentric and thinking, I don't, not off in meditation, I don't have sloth and torpor. I'm going to conquer sloth and torpor. I'm more powerful than nature. I'm going to strive. That's ego coming from the sense of self. Leave it alone. And after a while, it completely disappears. And when it disappears, you're left with peace, which is great. And the last hindrance is doubt. And again, doubt can go on many things. You can have doubt about yourself. Can you do this? Are you up to this? Is it possible that you can get into deep meditation? People sometimes have doubts about their own ability. Sometimes they think, oh, I'm too old. Sometimes they think, oh, I'm only a lay person. Oh, this is my first retreat. I am sick with gut ache. I am sick with this ache. I am sick with some other backache or whatever ache you've got. You think, oh, maybe other people could get into meditation, but not me. I'm too old. I'm too sick. I'm too stupid. Now, the Buddha said, there's only a certain group of people who can't succeed in meditation. Those are people who have shed the blood of a Buddha, who have killed their mother or father, who have killed an arahat, or who have raped a bhikkhuni. Has anyone here done any of those? Come on, confess. If you haven't done any of those, or cause a schism in the Sangha, if you haven't done any of those, then it's possible for you to become enlightened. So you don't have any doubts anymore that you can do it. According to what the Buddha said. Some people say, oh, I probably haven't got enough good karma from the past to be able to become enlightened in this life. And I say, oh, sadhu. You've recalled your past lives and all this. But you know just exactly what you've done and what you haven't done. It's a stupid thing to say, isn't it? Because you don't know. Give yourself the benefit of the doubt. It might be you this lifetime. Who knows? Not just this lifetime. This retreat, let alone this retreat, today could be your day. And the point is, it's that just encouragement. Anyone who's ever played sport knows success comes from having a good coach. Your ability is only a small ingredient. The coach is important as well. That's why most soccer teams, football teams, the coach gets paid sometimes the most money. Because having a motivator, someone who says, you can do this, means you succeed. There's been cases where, imagine that, you know, you were playing tennis. Say you were playing tennis against Roger Federer, or who's he? He's number one, is he? What about the lady, number one? What's that? Lindsay Davenport, you're playing against Lindsay Davenport. And you just never played anybody that before. And imagine I was your coach and say, listen, you've got no chance. You've got no hope. It's a waste of time even going on that court. They're going to beat you. They're much better than you. Would I be a good coach? Of course I would. That would give you absolutely no chance. If I went up there and said, look, they've got two legs, so have you. The ball is round, it can go both ways. Their racket is no bigger than your racket. And then when you encourage you, you say, yeah, I can do it. And that's why there are upsets. People who shouldn't win, they actually do win. People who shouldn't become enlightened, they do become enlightened. Just because you've got a good coach. That's my job. So what you do, you say, you can do it. And if you think you can do it. It's amazing, just the belief, the faith. There was once a disciple, he had such a hard job of watching his breath. He just could not do it. We had this great teacher. He said, okay, don't worry about that. Leave aside the breath. Now sit down, close your eyes, imagine you're watching the breath. Just imagine what it would be like if you could watch the breath. Imagine it. Sit down there and visualize yourself. And there's only imagination, it's not doing it properly, really. Imagine yourself watching the breath. Imagine yourself watching the breath going in, going out. What would it be like? Fill in the picture. And then after 2 or 3 minutes, he said, now what are you doing? He said, I'm watching the breath. The point was that he had doubts. He thought he couldn't do it. And because he thought he couldn't do it, he didn't do it. Because he thought, this is impossible. I've tried before, it doesn't work. I can't do this. That was his big obstacle, doubt. And he had this very, very skillful teacher who just said, don't try. Just imagine you're doing it. Imagine what it'd be like. Now, what are you doing? He was doing it. It tricked doubt into standing aside for a few moments to show that yes, he could do that. So you can meditate, you can get into the deepest meditations, If you can't get into jhana, just sit there and imagine what it might be like. Imagine what jhana will be like. Imagine just the bliss and the joy going in your mind. Imagine that. You're halfway there. So, because you're overcoming the doubt, and you get that encouragement. It's strange just how that doubt, the lack of belief in oneself, can just obstruct the meditations. Especially when you get deep in meditation, you get, say, a beautiful breath, you get a nimitta. Sometimes people say, oh, is this really a nimitta? Don't doubt it. Chances are it is. Give yourself the benefit of the doubt. Say it is. Because if you doubt, you start doing things and the mind will start to wobble and you lose it again. Encourage yourself. Even if it's only imagination, that's good enough. Because the imagination will turn into the real thing, give it enough time. Imagine it. Yeah. It gives you encouragement, inspiration. Don't doubt. Don't have ill will. Don't crush the mind. Be kind to the mind. Be kind to yourself. Even be kind to your meditation cushion or your seat. That's a practice which we do in some traditions. Say thank you, cushion, for looking after me. Thank you, chair, for supporting me. If you do that, you're developing loving kindness, appreciation, even towards your little seat which you're sitting on. And you find that seat will become more comfortable for you. As if your seat is trying even harder to support you and make your position less troublesome. Do a lot of loving kindness. Don't have desires of where you want to go, what you want to be. Just be here now. Allow this moment to be. Be more embracing, less demanding, less fault-finding. Look at the plates which have been washed rather than the plates which need to be done. Be thankful, be appreciative of how far you've already come in your meditation, not the journey which lies ahead. Oh, it's so wonderful just being this far. Those are the ways to get into deeper and deeper meditation. It just happens naturally. You're stopping the five hindrances, developing the opposites of contentment, peace, lack of fault finding, confidence that it's possible. And also the joy in the meditation. When that starts to come up, meditation gets so easy. And that's how it works. So look out for the five hindrances. Find out which one is your worst one. And do the opposites. And you'll find meditation flows easy. Meditation is the easiest thing in the world. We know how to do it. Just sit down there and let go. Not fault-finding, not demanding. Just being kind to everything. Being confident, it's going to happen, it's only a matter of time. Unless you've killed an arahat and raped a bhikkhuni. or shed the blood of a Buddha. If you haven't done any of those things, you're okay. So, that's the little talk this evening on inspiring you, encouraging you to overcome those five hindrances and get deep in meditation in this very life. Any questions? Yeah? Sorry? Now it's only this life. This life. We've learned the past life doesn't really matter. So you're free, you've done that. So, in fact, you've all got immense good karma. So just to come here and to be meditating for 9 days, how many other people in the world can find 9 days when they can spend just in meditation, practicing Dhamma and nothing else? My goodness, you've got huge good karma. But just coming here is good enough. Everything else is extra. Yeah?
Can you talk a bit about the hindrance of
restlessness? Oh, yeah, I forgot about restlessness, didn't I? Restlessness, what does restlessness come from? It comes from lack of contentment. Always wanting something else. What else do you want? What do you want in life? How about wanting peace? Just wanting the state of wanting nothing. When if you give up wanting, there's no more restlessness. Because restlessness is always thinking that when I get something else, then I'll be happy. Thinking about this, thinking about that. Why does restlessness happen? Why can't people actually sit still? Because they're uncomfortable. They want to go somewhere else. That's why this, you know, very often this happens. The people are looking in the refrigerator, there's nothing to eat. There's heaps to eat there, but they're not content with what's in the refrigerator. They go to the TV. And then how many, when I was young, they only had two channels. There's ITV and BBC in London. And then there's about 30 channels now, and 40 channels, especially you've got these cable TVs. There's nothing on. And one can never find a go out. There's no one to go out to. Look at what's on the movies. There's nothing on. There's always heaps on. There's heaps to do if one had contentment. But what restless is you're never content with anything. So instead of looking for something else, we're appreciating of what we have now. We're content with this moment, whatever it is. Don't wait to get jhanas before you're content. Be content in this moment. That's the opposite of restlessness. If you're content sitting on your cushion or on your chair, you don't want to move. You're resting. If this chair is not comfortable enough, there's another chair over there which you really like. You go to that chair, now that chair is not very nice, so you get another cushion on it. With restlessness, you end up bringing your bed in here. And even that's not comfortable enough, you have to get a second mattress, you pinch a mattress from somebody else. So whatever it is, restlessness is always, you're never happy. It always gives you more discontent. So just be content with what you have. Actually, I did mention the main cause of restlessness is fault finding. This is never good enough. My meditation is never good enough. The cushion's never good enough. The teacher's never good enough. The place is never good enough. Life is never good enough. So it's always going off looking for something else. That's called restlessness. Once you know that this is good enough, now you can rest. But thank you, because I missed that one out. I did mention it in passing, but I forgot to mention it specifically. Thank you very much. Is there any other question which you have? Yeah, go on.
John, if you are not doing all the time when you have a meditation, I don't think I can concentrate. How can you concentrate?
This concentration will come to you. So you're saying that when you're nodding in meditation, you can't really concentrate. Don't try and concentrate. Just try letting go. Allowing the nodding to be. Be kind to your nodding. Say, nodding, the door of my heart is open to you. You can nod as long as you like. Give yourself permission to nod for the rest of this retreat, for the whole 7 or 8 days. And if you give permission like that, it's almost like reverse psychology. You stop very quickly. It's just like, she's not here. We had a vice president, not this year, the year before. She's a very, very successful business lady and very effective. The way I got her to be vice president of our Buddhist society, so I went to see her and said, look, we're looking for a vice president. She said, no, I can't be the vice president. I'm working so hard. I've got so many duties and responsibilities. I said, yes, I know that. That's why I'm telling you, you can't be the vice president. I know some people are thinking of inviting to be the vice president, but look, I will not support that. You can't be the vice president. You shouldn't do that. And I made it very clear. It's Rachel last year. I made it very clear to her. And she was a intelligent lady. But, you know, she fell right into the trap. 4 or 5 days later, she called me up on Monday. She said, why can't I be vice president? I want to be vice president. I've got you. And she was vice president for the year. She fell right into it. It's great psychology. So give yourself permission. Say, mind, you can nod. Come on, nod. We get into it. And then you stop nodding.
Is it equivalent to sleepiness or drowsiness?
It is, yes. Yeah. It's loss and torpor when you're nodding. But it's nature. Allow it to happen. Now, you're not in control. You should know this by now. You live long enough. So allow the nature to be in control. It's part of nature. That doesn't matter. I'll put some cushions in front of there. Maybe get safety belts. Airbags. No, you have to fall off. Actually, though, they used to, you know, these sort of novices used to have in Thailand. They used to always be good fun, because sometimes we used to have these like all-night functions, when you have these famous monks coming up and giving talks throughout the night. And they're supposed to be famous monks, but you know, they always get bored after a while. So the entertainment of the night, we'd always like the middle monks, we'd look down the end of the line where the little novices were sitting. They had to sit up as well. And because they're little novices, and they were the best nodders, and you see them starting nodding. Now, because you were monks in Thailand, you were sitting up on these benches, maybe about sort of, you know, 2 foot above the ground. And they weren't all that wide benches, and so you'd see these novices starting to nod. And you know, you'd almost be sort of, not really making bets, but you'd just say which one you thought was going to fall off first. he's going, and I know it's going to be that one over there, I'm sure. They'd be waiting, it's really exciting. Because they start nodding more and more and more, and they're getting close. And the lay people would get into it as well, because they were bored with the talks, they were watching little novices. And then sooner or later, one would fall off. And everyone would start laughing. Because the way we have our robes, when you fall off like that, you know, you see every part of the anatomy. And that was our entertainment for the night. The poor little novices. I know it's a bit cruel, but you know, that's what you did as a young man. I don't know about compassion about monsters. But yeah, so that's why people wear trousers these days. So no, you don't fall off. So just an act, because after a while the sleepiness disappears and then you're nice and peaceful. Don't make it a big deal. That's not a bad hindrance. The restlessness is much worse when you can never stop the mind at all. If you can nod, at least you can be peaceful. There's one monk I grew up with, it's a French monk. He was always sitting absolutely straight. Just, you know, like that story of the Buddha. But he disrobed after 3 or 4 years. And I always thought, because he never used to talk very much, he was a very silent monk. And I asked him, we all thought you were almost close to enlightenment. You never nodded, you were just so still. He said that was because I was trying to control it. All my life I was just controlling. I could never find a moment of peace. He said sometimes he'd open his eyes and look at all the other monks who were nodding. He said he felt so jealous. At least you guys could have a bit of peace. As for me, my mind was always very busy. I always remember that. He that was said from the heart. He really meant that. And sometimes, at least when you're nodding, you have some peace. Your mind isn't controlling, isn't thinking. So that's why you may have psychic powers soon. Okay, so I think that's enough for the talk. So.